You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of July 2021 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily is brought to you in association with Allianz.
The UK's government finds that controlling borders is easier said than done. Tokyo's Olympics maybe don't make plans for the opening ceremony just yet. France loses patience with the unjabbed. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily in association with Allianz starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Our guests, Mary Dajewski and Robin Lustig, will discuss all the day's big stories. We'll find out if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is ever going to keep Germans warm. And the author Marie Leconte will introduce her new book, celebrating the lives of some of Britain's stranger MPs. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily in association with Allianz on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Mary Dajewski, foreign affairs commentator and columnist for The Independent, and by the journalist and broadcaster Robin Lustig. Welcome both. We will be talking presently about the Olympics looming this weekend. So by way of light introductory banter, I did want to ask you both if you have any particularly special fondly treasured Olympics memories of your own. Mary?
Well, I have very fond memories of London 2012 because I was one of the pink-clad volunteers, not one of those in the stadium with the big hands, alas. I was directing people around Hyde Park, but it was absolutely, it was like a magical time in London, just those couple of weeks. Everybody was walking around, flags from practically every nation on earth were being paraded around the capital. Everybody was in a fantastic mood. And of course, it rained colossally for, I think, the first 3 days non-stop. So a very good time was had by all.
See, my abiding memory of London 2012, which I think came up in a similar context quite recently, was nearly getting mown down on Leytonstone High Road by the South African men's cycling team who were taking a practice run. Robin, do you have any fond memories of either that or any other Olympiad?
Well, I'm probably one of the least sporty people it's possible for you to talk to about this, but London 2012 was a bit different, and I thought it would be remiss of me not to partake in any way at all. So instead of going to the Olympics, my wife and I decided to go to the Paralympics, and unlike Mary's climatic recollections, I remember it being stinking hot and the sun shining, blazing down on us on the Olympic Stadium, and yes, I actually loved it hugely. London 2012 was one of the best memories, I think, for many Londoners of recent decades.
Not least because we all thought it was going to be a colossal disaster.
Yes, we were pleasantly surprised.
OK, well, we will start today, however, with the latest stramash in the eternally rancorous relationship between the United Kingdom and its oldest sparring partner, France. It has been the contention of the UK for some while that France's efforts to prevent unauthorised crossings of the Channel between them have been somewhat half-hearted. Nevertheless, the UK paid France £28.2 million last November to fund the interdiction of migrant boats, another £54.2 million more recently. Nevertheless, the boats keep coming. The total for 2021 to date already exceeds 2020's 8,461 Channel crossing migrants, with a single day record of 430 this past Monday. Robin, how hard do we reckon France is really trying here?
Probably not as hard as the UK would like it to, but I really think it is a great shame that we, the media, and certainly the current UK government, concentrate exclusively on the number of people coming to this country to seek asylum by boat. The overall numbers are actually lower now than they have been in many years
in
the past. 2,000 people in a year coming across the Channel. I mean, that's barely more than the people who are on a London tube train in the rush hour. It's an infinitesimal number. And then you look at where these people are coming from, and the latest figures I've seen suggest that the countries that most asylum seekers come from are countries like Iran, Eritrea, Iraq. Are we really saying that those people have no right to try to seek asylum in the UK?
Mary, has this particular government bought itself a bunch of trouble on this one by going so big as it did, both to get elected and to steer Brexit through on the controlling the borders motif? That was the thing they were going to do. And I think, to Robin's point about a relatively small number of people arriving in this fashion by boat, that is true. It's a small number of them, but it's a very visible small number of them. And it's a far more jarring news image than a bunch of people getting off an aeroplane.
Yes, and I think it's colossally damaging to a government which says, you know, we're here to protect the borders, we're taking back control, and all those slogans. They've been lucky in a way that because of the pandemic and because the numbers have fallen, in part because of the pandemic, it hasn't registered. The whole business of migration, legal or otherwise, has not figured on government radar or in public opinion nearly as much as it could otherwise have done. But I have to admit that, probably unlike Robin, I'm a bit of a hardliner on people crossing the channel, because I do think that there is, you know, a first duty of government is to protect its borders, and not to know who is coming in or who is trying to come into the country. It just seems to me a colossal dereliction of duty. It's where I actually agree with the Brexiteers to this extent, that I think you are a country which claims that it can defend its sovereignty has to defend its borders. And it seems to me that having, you know, 400 people or so coming by dinghies and being rescued by the lifeboat service, that is really not protecting our borders.
But my response to that would be that it's a direct consequence of the way in which the UK government has made it almost impossible for would-be refugees to seek asylum in this country by any other means. I mean, if you are somebody in Eritrea, say, or in Sudan, wishing to seek asylum in the UK, there is virtually no legal way or safe way that you can do that. And the UK government does have certain international obligations under the convention, UN Convention on Refugees, to deal with these asylum applications properly.
Yes, and I agree. And I also agree that the image, as it were, of people crossing the channel give a distorted impression of what's actually going on, because that's a relatively small proportion of people who either claim asylum or want to claim asylum. But, you know, we don't actually know, because we had the appalling episode, when was it, a couple of years ago, of young Vietnamese being found dead in a truck.
In a truck, yeah.
That had come over the channel. Now, what that said was how many are actually coming in trucks every day, entirely safely, and then being let out into the UK. I mean, we do not know who is here. And I suppose that something that I would never have said up to about 5 years ago was that I actually think we ought to have ID cards, because I think that is, you know, that would at least be half a way of tracking who is here at some point. And the downside of not knowing who is here was in a way illustrated by the Windrush scandal, where we discovered that all sorts of people who were here entirely legally were being singled out by the Immigration Service as not being here legally, and had to prove all over again because they'd got no documents.
Which again is a consequence of what Andrew referred to, this sort of rather cruel and inhumane government rhetoric that we will close our borders, or at least control our borders, and we will only
except in the event of a global pandemic, when it would actually make sense
exactly
to do it, in which case, fine.
The other thing that annoys me about this is the dishonesty of the rhetoric, which suggests that somehow the UK is uniquely affected by this problem. Countries like Germany and France have several times more asylum applications per year than the UK, and make much less fuss about it. The rhetoric in the UK is deeply dishonest, deeply inhumane. I agree, Andrew, I've got to accept, I speak personally and with some passion about this, both my parents were refugees. Mm-hmm. They came to this country from Nazi Germany. I am emotionally on the side of refugees.
But is there an, I mean, the trouble is, though, Robert, I think there's something to what you say, that a more generous and expansive refugee program would probably, or at least one would hope, have a, you know, a mitigating effect on the kind of arrivals we're talking about. But again, even if that makes obvious sense, and I'm a big fan of expansive and generous refugee programmes. My own country, Australia, for all that it has taken the hard line on boats, has benefited incalculably from successive generations of refugees. But this government, even if it's got into the position now, even if it would make sense to do that, and it would, even if you just look at what people are now saying about post-Brexit labour shortages, even if it makes absolutely perfect sense, they can't do it, can they?
You mean politically?
Yeah.
Well, they are hoist with their own petard, aren't they? I mean, they have spent years saying there are too many illegal immigrants, in brackets, would-be asylum seekers are not illegal immigrants, they're a different category. Too many illegal immigrants, too many foreign criminals coming to our shores.
Double brackets, we actually don't know how many. We haven't a clue within a couple of million.
There is some truth to that, I accept. But nevertheless, I mean, they are hoist with their own petard. The rhetoric has been there for years and years, and unfortunately, sufficient numbers of people have believed them. And of course, they can't deliver. We are an island with lots of coastlines and shorelines, and we can't control every inch of it.
OK, well, let's move along to that Olympics-related discussion that we cunningly foreshadowed at the top of the show. Or more accurately, let's maybe look at if there actually are any Tokyo Olympics to look ahead to. Because despite this Friday's opening ceremony now being closer than most of us would feel comfortable cancelling a lunch engagement, and despite indeed the fact that some events are already underway, Toshiro Muto, the head of the Tokyo 2020 Organising Committee, has suggested that the plug may yet be pulled if COVID-19 infections get out of hand, whatever the definition of that may be. Mary, I'll declare my own stance on this up front. As of Japan's monstrous defeat of Australia in the women's softball, I am absolutely of the view that the whole thing should just be written off, scrapped, abandoned. There is no point in going on. No, but seriously, I mean, this is mad, isn't it? I mean, if there might have been an argument. This is an argument you have 6 months ago, right?
No, I mean, absolutely. And you do have to ask why it's anywhere near going ahead. But also you can look back a year and you can say, well, think about all the athletes, that everybody is trained with a view to months, even, you know, not even next year, but, you know, to be at absolute peak form for the next Olympics, and to postpone by a year just about allows those same athletes to compete. To postpone it by 2 years, or even to cancel it, and to wait for the next 4 year cycle. I mean, that's incredibly hard on the people who were selected to take part. I also think, I mean, I feel really, really sorry for Japan, because I think that this was a huge opportunity for Japan, and I think they wanted to use it to make Japan more accessible and more navigable by tourists from around the world. It seemed quite closed and quite difficult to make your way around, quite difficult to penetrate in all sorts of ways. You know, language, the script, just the way things are done. And this was a huge opportunity for Japan, and it's been erased, absolutely erased.
I do indeed feel the same sympathy for Japan, and I feel sympathy for, you know, Olympics viewers around the world, myself very much among them, because I'm sure in normal circumstances Japan would have put on an absolutely fantastic games. Robin, if they are able to put on any kind of games at all, is there a question from a sporting position that that any medals will be compromised? And I just want to forestall that by saying I don't want to make that question in any way sound begrudging. I can barely conceive of the kind of dedication and effort it takes to even get tickets to the Olympics, never mind actually go to the Olympics as a competitor. But we have already seen one of Great Britain's medal hopes, Amber Hill, a skeet shooter, having to bail out after a positive COVID-19 test. And I know you can only beat what's put in front of you. It's one of the great sporting adages. But will there always be an asterisk next to gold medals from these games?
I doubt it, actually. If the events do go ahead, and I have to say, I sort of hope they do at this stage, because like you, I do feel for the athletes themselves. I think, you know, as time goes on, if you say that you were an Olympic medal winner in 2021 or 2020, I'm not even sure what they're going to call them, because the Euros, of course, they call 2020, even though...
No, they're sticking with 2020.
They're sticking with 2020.
I think because they'd already printed the T-shirts by that point.
There is one other aspect to this, and it's probably not very nice of me to say this, but I am in a way reassured that a government with a reputation for actually... handling a pandemic rather well, has found itself completely in almost as much of a mess as the UK government over this. They clearly are being pulled in every direction by their own electorate, on the one hand, who are terrified about the effect that these games might have on the spread of the virus, and the International Olympic Committee and the sponsors, on the other hand, who are saying to them, you've damn well got to go ahead because there are billions of dollars invested in this. And it's very difficult for them to strike a balance. In my view, they should have said a year ago, when admittedly they thought they'd got the virus beat, they should have said, we're going to postpone for at least 2 years, not just for 1 year, and then stuck to it.
Robin and Mary, thank you both very much for the moment. We'll have more from you later in the show. But we turn now to the vexed question of Nord Stream 2, the mighty Baltic Sea pipeline, which will be capable of doubling the natural gas carried from Russia to Germany. It was a topic of some of the less relaxed portions of the recent meeting between German Chancellor Angela Merkel and US President Joe Biden. The US and others are unkeen on Nord Stream 2, believing it a boon to Russian President Vladimir Putin, whose regime will be presented not merely with a cash cow, but a formidable diplomatic weapon. However, there is now some suggestion that an agreement between the US and Germany on this subject is looming. Well, I'm joined with more by Elizabeth Brohr, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Elizabeth, before we talk about any potential agreement, just for a matter of perspective, how much does the US dislike Nord Stream 2?
Well, if you're Donald Trump, you absolutely hate it with a vengeance. And if you're Republican senators and if you're Democratic senators, you energetically dislike it too. There are no sort of neutral feelings about Nord Stream. And the funny thing, or not so funny, the unfunny thing is that there is bipartisan agreement in disliking Nord Stream 2. But Biden, Joe Biden, as you said, seems to have come around to supporting it.
Is he going to want any sort of assurances, guarantees, concessions to come all the way around to supporting it?
Well, so the problem with Nord Stream 2 is that it has caused this major rift between Germany and the US, or between the US and Germany. That has essentially halted transatlantic cooperation for a number of years now. And so I think Biden just concluded that to cut his losses, or to cut America's losses, would be the most productive way forward, because Nord Stream dominates every single conversation involving Germany and the US, and they don't barely get to anything else. So he just decided that now he'll sacrifice this issue because there are so many things America needs to do with Germany. And if I may add, that includes the refugees that Germany is likely to receive, the refugee wave that is likely to head Germany's way as a result of America pulling out of Afghanistan. So he needs Germany. And he and Angela Merkel seems to have pulled off a fantastic visit in Washington, convincing him to change his mind on her way out of the office.
Given the bipartisan hostility to Nord Stream 2 in the United States that you described there, is this going to be a politically easy sell for Joe Biden? Is this going to be portrayed as some sort of climb down?
Yes, it will be. And it's already being attacked or criticized, vigorously criticized by Central and Eastern Europeans and by some in Germany. But the fact is, it was such a colossus, or such a damper on the German-US relationship that nothing else could be done. And so I think both leaders, especially Biden, decided that that criticism at home, the criticism in Central and Eastern Europe, was worth the price of getting past this with Germany.
I mean, is there any argument, and has Germany indeed tried to make any argument, that there is actually something to be said for this from Europe's point of view diplomatically, in that it does make Russia more economically dependent on Western Europe, and therefore perhaps, if we're being hilariously optimistic, makes Vladimir Putin or his successors perhaps likely to behave themselves a little bit better?
Well, there has always been the school of thought in international relations that if you engage countries that don't behave quite the way you want them to, they'll come around to your side and start behaving better. And there's evidence for that, but there is also evidence against it, primarily China. And incidentally, I think China is one of the key issues here in this equation, even though China is in no way involved with the Baltic Sea pipeline, because what the US has done until now is impose unilateral sanctions on Nord Stream and various so companies associated with it. But even though they don't violate any laws in the countries where they are based. And so that is really not very nice, if I may say, from an international order perspective. You can't just go around imposing sanctions on companies you don't like. And Biden, I think, realized that if America does that with companies America doesn't like, China may well do it with US companies when the US does something China doesn't like. And China has shown that it doesn't care what the rest of the world thinks. It will punish companies willy-nilly. We've seen it with Ericsson, we've seen it with H&M, Nike, Burberry. Why not other American companies?
Elizabeth Brauer, thanks as always for joining us. This is the Monocle Daily. I'll be back with our panel right after this.
For more than 130 years, Allianz has expanded its business and stretched its brand in new and innovative ways. And while the world looks very different today than it did back in 1890, one truth remains. Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. Another core principle at Allianz is a belief in equality of opportunity and that diversity makes a company more innovative, more resilient, and better equipped for the future. Renata Wagner is the board member at Allianz responsible for mergers and acquisitions, human resources, group legal, group compliance, and group data protection. With that broad portfolio, Renata has a pretty unique perspective on how those Allianz core values shape the company's approach. Renata is with us today to tell us about how Allianz is addressing an incredibly complex and sensitive subject, mental health. Renata Wagner, thanks for being with us. Can you talk a little bit, Renata, about how that connection is made, that connection between mental health and well-being? One presumes there must be a holistic approach, but how do you and your colleagues in Allianz make that link?
Well, I think the starting point was that we look at it, as you say, in a very holistic manner. And when I say holistic, basically the way we approach it, both the well-being as well as the mental health, or I would say health in general terms, is along three dimensions. The first dimension we look at is mental and physical resilience. So, for example, through coaching hotlines for people leaders and regular check-in calls with them. The second dimension we considered is the motivation and the engagement, because that drives a lot of the well-being of our employees. So, for example, we put in place virtual team building events, virtual coffee sessions, inspiring sessions with Olympic and Paralympic athletes, just to give you some examples. And the third dimension, how we approached it, was the work effectiveness. So we put in place, for example, meeting etiquettes, where we shortened the meetings from 30 minutes to 25 minutes or from 60 to 50 minutes to make sure that there are breaks available between the virtual meetings and between the calls. Or we also put in place, in this third dimension, things like meeting-free days for employees. That's another initiative which we applied in one of our large entities, is the No Hectic Monday, which means that meetings on a Monday should only start after 10 a.m. So these are some examples, but it is, to your question, it's this holistic approach in these three dimensions that connects the two topics, mental health on the one side and well-being on the other side.
Renata Wagner on Allianz's passion for securing people's lives and giving them courage for what's ahead, no matter what. Allianz. Confidence in tomorrow.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are our guests Mary Dajewski and Robin Lustig. Well, let's return to France, where life is about to become noticeably more constrained for the unvaccinated. President Emmanuel Macron has made it clear over the last couple of weeks in a series of escalatingly impatient-sounding harumphs that those who abjure the jab will be developing an increasingly intimate relationship with their sofas. As of today, you cannot get into a French museum, swimming pool or cinema, among other venues, or onto a plane or long-distance train without the new health pass confirming either a COVID-19 vaccination or a recent negative test. Mary, were such any regime to be instituted here in the UK, would you have any great problem with it?
I have a problem in principle, in practice, from a entirely realistic perspective. I think it's going to happen. I don't see how it can be avoided. But the question is it actually going to be introduced, and is it being introduced in France as a measure, as it were, in itself, because a health pass is something which they think is required and is beneficial for society in general, or is it intended as an incentive for all the people who've refused to be vaccinated to think again and think of all the things they would be unable to do, and therefore they think again? And to an extent, it seems the latter, because within hours of Macron's first announcement, that I think he said that in September. You would need a health pass, a vaccination pass to go into restaurants or nightclubs or whatever, but not until September. And within hours of that announcement, they had more than a million people registering to have vaccinations who hadn't had vaccinations. And it was interesting to me also that within maybe 48 hours of that announcement by Macron, who other than Boris Johnson was out there suddenly talking about vaccination passes for nightclubs also in September, to pretty much of an outcry in the UK? But I think he saw the response to Macron in France and said, well, if that's the response in France, if that's the way for younger people to accept being vaccinated, then let's give it a go.
Robin, this phrase vaccine passports, we will hear a lot of. Do you think it is actually analogous properly to what we think of as a passport? Because, of course, there's a similar dynamic there in that ownership of a passport is not compulsory. You're not made to have one. And indeed, it's actually quite expensive to get one, he said in the process of renewing his. But obviously, the downside is that if you don't have a passport, you're not going anywhere.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think Mary makes an important point. There is this sort of favoured theory in government these days, what's called the nudge theory, which is that you don't pass a law so much as say to people, unless you do what we think you ought to do, there will be certain things that you can't do. There are certain analogies. I mean, for example, in this country and in most other countries in Europe now, you can't smoke in a public place. Now, that is an infringement of your freedom, of your liberty to make decisions about your own health. But it is imposed for public health benefit in order to protect other people from the effects of your smoke. Vaccine passports, it seems to me, are designed to do exactly the same thing, to protect other people from your sense of what is right for you. There is an odd tradition in the UK of opposition to anything that smacks of an ID card. And I've never understood it, to be honest. I've lived in several countries which have had ID cards, and I've never really had the sensation that they were any less free than the Brits are. So I think it would be really difficult to introduce in this country. I have certain misgivings about the extent to which government would be able to ensure that the information contained on any kind of digital vaccine passport wasn't spread into other areas from which we'd rather it wasn't. I mean, we've just had over the last few days the most extraordinary series of stories about the way in which some Israeli-made software can invade your mobile phone and switch on its microphone and its camera without you even knowing. So I do have concerns about privacy. But in general, yes, I think this is the way that we are going to go. And I think probably it is the right way.
There was a there was what I found was a very interesting survey that came out. I mean, just a couple of hours before we came on air, and with all the qualifications about surveys, you know, who was being surveyed, how many people, what, etc., etc. In this country, it was found that 55% of people under 30 thought it would be absolutely okay for a vaccine pass to be demanded for entrance to such things as nightclubs and public events and football matches and things like that. And I think that was a lot more than the people sort of conducting the survey had expected. I think that they expected that it would be maybe 20, 30%, but more, a majority, now not a huge majority, but a majority. I think if the government is sort of watching that, it'll find it quite encouraging.
It is really interesting. I think one of the most interesting things about this whole pandemic, one of the things we've learned, is that the general public are actually far more prepared to accept restrictions on their freedom of movement for the benefit of public health than government and certain sections of the media would have us believe. Throughout the pandemic, the impression one gets from opinion polls is that the majority of people have been in favour of moving slowly to lift restrictions, have been in favour of retaining, for example, the legal requirement to wear masks in public places, and this is just one aspect of it.
Well, let's move to something completely different, because as if hoping to cheer up a COVID-beleaguered UK, well, almost all of it, UNESCO has stripped Liverpool of its World Heritage status, prompting a nationwide chorus of puerile guffawing, rivaled since UNESCO gave Liverpool World Heritage status in 2004. Liverpool's defrocking is a consequence, it says here, of the extant and planned redevelopment of its waterfront to include a new stadium for Everton Football Club. And before anybody from Liverpool writes in, at the risk of stereotyping Liverpudlians as the kind of people who would, I've been to Liverpool several times, enjoyed it very much, and hope to return one day. Please, please don't send me any angry letters. This is the third ever stripping, Robin, I put it to you, of World Heritage status by UNESCO. Can you name the previous two?
Well, if it hadn't been for the fact that this item was reported today and I had read in paragraph 15 what the two were, I can remember, I think one is in Oman, and I can't at the moment remember where the other one was.
It is. It's an Arabian oryx sanctuary in Oman and the Dresden Elbe Valley.
That's
in
right. Well, I never knew that either of them did have UNESCO protected status, and I certainly didn't know they'd been stripped of it. Do you know what? I think Liverpool will survive this. I don't think the people of Liverpool really give two hoots what UNESCO thinks about their waterfront. Like you, I've been to Liverpool. I think it's a great city. I particularly like the waterfront. I just don't think Liverpool is going to lose any sleep over this, or at least it shouldn't lose any sleep over this.
You are banking on Liverpudlians to absorb this slight with the sense of proportion and equanimity for which they have become famous?
I couldn't have put it better.
Mary, does this say perhaps rather more about UNESCO's self-importance than anything Liverpool might have done wrong?
Well, I think it does, but I'm also slightly worried that it actually sends a message to people who might visit Liverpool, and especially from outside the UK. I was actually a late convert to Liverpool. It was one of the few big cities in England that I hadn't been to. And so I went, in fact, just 2 years ago, very soon before lockdown. And I thought it was the most fabulous place. And I thought they've done a job on resurrecting
God, we're
both
all really
Docklands
terrified
area
of the angry emails, aren't we?
But also the downtown. I mean, most people have regenerated their downtowns and ruined them. Liverpool seemed to me to be a complete exception for that reason. But I do think that, I mean, I have a slight sympathy with UNESCO in one respect, that seeing some of the plans for the new stadium, and I think there's going to be a cruise terminal, I really, really hope that they fit in with the scale of the waterfront as it is, because you look at the City of London and you see the extent of modern development that simply doesn't respect the scale of what was there before. And I think that is that's just so catastrophic with so many developments, especially in this country. Germans, as so often, seem to do it better, so do the French and so do the Italians, that they have a greater respect for how things fit in. And I just hope that Liverpool actually keeps the waterfront as so as the sort of dominant feature, because that really is the signature of Liverpool, and it would be such a pity to obscure it.
I agree with all of that, Mary, but on your point about foreign visitors, I mean, I have to say, as somebody who has travelled a great deal and spends quite a lot of time planning where my next trip will be, I have never once looked at a list of UNESCO World Heritage sites and thought to myself, which ones do I now need to
Fair
visit?
Fair enough.
I think I'm not alone in having first understood that Liverpool was actually listed by UNESCO when I discovered this week that it was to be unlisted. Robin Lustig and Mary Dejewski, thank you both for joining us on the Monocle Daily. Finally on today's show, it may seem, perhaps especially to listeners in the UK, that a book about politicians who aren't notably odd might be shorter than one about politicians who are. Such cynicism notwithstanding, it is the case that politics as a trade attracts unusual people and tends not to make them any more usual. Marie Leconte, the journalist, author and regular daily panellist, has compiled the lives of some of the more obviously peculiar in a hugely entertaining new book called Honourable Misfits, a brief history of Britain's weirdest, unluckiest and most outrageous MPs. I spoke to Mari earlier and began by asking if anybody who even wants to be an MP is at least a little bit odd by definition.
It is. The slight caveat I would have is that it's, I think, in current times, it is definitely objectively weird to want to become a member of parliament and to remain a member of parliament. But I think a few sort of, you know, quite decades, maybe centuries ago, it was kind of just a thing you did, I think, if you were rich. But yeah, so certainly now, I think you have to be actively odd to be like, oh, you know, that horror show, I want to be a part of it.
The book is further subdivided into what you classify as the eccentrics, the unfortunate, the adventurous, the lustful, and the idle. I'm kind of disappointed they got bracketed into one chapter rather than having one of their own.
Most of the lustfuls were quite idle as well, because that's most of, you know, what they did, so...
Well, I know, but being lustful can be quite hard work.
That is true.
Is my point. The outlaws and the villains and the assorted mavericks. How much fun did you have classifying various MPs into which of those brackets? Was there a spreadsheet involved?
No, so I actually did it at the end and it was really, really tough because I sort of reread it and I slightly felt like, I don't know, a school teacher or something looking at every kid going, you know, like some sort of Harry Potter thing, like, you know, in the sorting hats or something, looking at every entry going like, what are you? Because especially I think there's quite, and in this address in the introduction, there's quite a lot of overlap because there's people that say, okay, were you more evil than a shagger? Or did you shag more than you travelled? That was genuinely very fun.
Did you have any, I guess, boundaries around good taste? Did anybody get ruled out just on the grounds of just being objectively terrible and therefore really no fun at all?
So many paedophiles. It's really hard not to laugh because it was generally, it became very bleakly comical when I was doing the research for the book because, and I decided very early on that obviously, you know, paedophiles I would not include at all because I think that crossed the line. But the amount of MPs, especially, you know, and even actually I'd say especially a long time ago, but not necessarily, you know, it's kind of start reading about them and be like, okay, you're quite eccentric, quite weird, quite fun. Oh, you know, like a bit of a weird one. Read some more. Oh, no. Like, you know, it's always the Wikipedia, you know, kind of scroll down to allegations. It's, oh, God, again. So, no, actually, I would say I probably ruined at least sort of like 6 or 7 MPs, even ones that were just rumours at the time. I was like, you know what, we can maybe not, because then it's a very uneasy choice of do I mention it and kind of just like bring the mood down, or do I not mention it? But then that's perhaps a bit weird. So, you know, definitely that. And then I think there's a few mega racists I didn't include, which was quite a tough one, because obviously... most politicians in Britain were very racist until quite recently, so it was a slightly weird job of going, okay, were you more racist than the time?
It was the default setting until really quite recently, I guess.
It was, so yeah, so I think there were a few people who were like, okay, well, you did really go above and beyond, so like racism-wise, so maybe, you know, it's not a good idea to include you. But then, you know, there is also an entire bit on villains, so quite a few of those people are just very much, like, were just awful people, criminals, etc., but... mostly quite entertaining, I hope.
I was quite fond of Faked His Own Death guy, John Stonehouse. I think that takes nerve above and beyond the mere usual foibles.
Oh, yeah, no, I am a big fan, and it's... I think it's also a story quite a lot of people may have heard of in kind of, you know, quite vague terms, etc. But I think researching it was quite fun because there are so many other different bits. So, for example, the fact that he actually died, I'm pretty sure, on the spot while doing a television show in his later years on people who disappeared and, you know, either faked their own death or kind of disappeared. That was a good one. I think, weirdly, one of my favourite ones is one of the earliest ones, is William Long, who lived in the 14th century. He was a pirate, which, I mean, is great in and of itself. But it's the fact that, so he was from Hastings. And I think that was around the time when England was trying to do early trade deals with Holland, with the Netherlands. And that guy basically just kept pillaging sort of like Flemish boats, Flemish ships. And so Flemish just kept getting angrier and angrier. And it kind of got to the point of saying, like, please, we are doing this trade deal. Can you, 2 months, can you, just for 2 months, can you please not pillage a ship? And he was like, yes, fine. And then he would do it again. But also because he brought back so many riches to Hastings, no one would give him up when he was back on land. And yeah, and eventually they elected him as his MP.
You do write about some plain unlucky ones. And there's some moments of considerable bathos in there. There's the one who dies by tripping over a turnip, which is just not something you ever want on your epitaph. But you do mention Spencer Percival, who I think does emerge as kind of weirdly the tragic hero of your book. He is famously, as every pub quiz habitue knows, the only British Prime Minister ever to have been assassinated in office. But you also make the point that he was actually doing a reasonably decent job when somebody shot him.
Yeah, he is a bit of a weird one in the book, in that the entire section is largely about MPs who are not that interesting but died in funny or compelling or especially sad ways. And this is very much the opposite of, you know, you'll have heard of that MP, but you probably don't really, really know what he got up to beforehand. And I think the consensus was when he was PM, like before he got murdered, that he was sort of getting better and better. So he'd had a bit of a rocky start, but was becoming quite a competent prime minister and was, again, like quite broadly liked. And then obviously he was killed. So, you know, I did enjoy being able to say, like, hello, you know, for once, like, this is not just me being silly. This is also like someone who probably should be remembered for something else. And obviously, you know, I do like the fact that on a silly note, that the descendant of the man who murdered him, I believe, was in the Commons for a while.
Indeed he was. Would obviously be fairly undesirable to have an entire parliament composed, well, of the people in your book. You can't really run a country exclusively from the deliberations of maniacs. But do you think there is actually something to be said for having at least a smattering of mavericks, the sort of the definition of smattering or proportion that constitutes a smattering to be decided? Does it help a basically grown-up country or to have a few oddballs in its legislature?
Oh, absolutely. And also because I think there's a kind of wider question here, a wider sort of thing, in that voters, I think, are quite hypocritical in that all they say that, oh, you know, we want MPs to be real people, you know, and to kind of be their own person and not just be complete sort of like bots following their leadership and kind of just doing what they're told and repeating the same things over and over again. But then the second an MP acts like a normal human being, they're like, oh, not like that, Jesus Christ. And it's like, well, yeah, you know what? If you want people who are like real people are quite often just really, really weird. I was absolutely encouraged, I think, every parliament to have a sort of quota of oddballs. I like the idea of like constituency drawing from a lot and saying, yeah, so sorry, for the next 5 years, just going to have a really weird MP. But yeah, but I think Parliament needs it because, again, yeah, you know, they're just trying to represent the country, and the country has many, you know, many people who are adventurous or lustful and idle or eccentrics or very unlucky and so on.
It's probably best if you answer this question without naming any names, but is there a currently or are there currently serving members of the British Parliament who you thought about including or who might merit inclusion on the merits of what is known of their oddness?
What I will say is, I think, and that's oddly a debate I had with a friend recently of like what counts as an eccentric, especially in politics. And I think, you know, and there are a few exceptions in the book, obviously like Spencer Percival, but very, very few. I think mostly political eccentrics tend to not really have much power and then seem to be either not that interested in power or interested in it in a way that is so unhelpful that, you know, they'll never get anywhere. And yeah, for me, the very obvious example would be Jacob Rees-Mogg. So like pre-Brexit, Jacob Rees-Mogg would have been such an obvious addition to the book. You know, the fact that he wasn't it like, he had shares and stocks, etc., at the age of 12 and would attend like AGMs. And you know, it was just like, it is just an all-round, I used to know him a bit through my job. Just, you know, very odd man. But the problem is he eventually got given a job in government. And now it's no longer funny. Like, it's not, you know, it's not. Like, you were meant to be the light entertainment, really. When what was it that like, he wanted to give Somerset, like his constituency, its own time zone. Very funny as a backbencher. He's in cabinet now. Oh, no, that is not, I think, you know, it's one of the things I think we want eccentrics in Parliament. We do not want them in government.
Marie Leconte there, and her book, Honourable Misfits, A Brief History of Britain's Weirdest, Unluckiest and Most Outrageous MPs, is out tomorrow, and you should buy it. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks again to our panellists today, Mary Dejewski and Robin Lustig, also to Elizabeth Brough and Marie Leconte. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thank you for listening.